You are listening to A Window on the Past on West Limerick 102 FM. Tom Toomey, you are back to talk to us about Easter 1916 in the Limerick area.
Yeah, quite a number of things happened in the Limerick area, if you take the general Limerick area. On Good Friday, two men from Limerick, Tommy McInerney and Sam Windham, were delegated to go to drive to Killarney and pick up five men who were travelling from Dublin. And they were to drive on Cathair Sabine. Now, Cathair Sabine would be quite close to Valentia.
Yes.
And there was a radio training school in Cathair Sabine, the Shields Radio School. Now, what you've got to realise is that the transatlantic cable went from Valentia to America.
Okay.
So there was a radio training school in Cathair Sabine that would have, you know, transmitting equipment.
Yes.
And it was envisaged that these five men coming from Dublin, now they were under the command of a man called Paddy Daly. There was a Colm O'Loughlin. Charles Monaghan, right? Daniel Sheehan, and who was the other man? Can't think of the other guy. Monaghan, right?
Okay.
Now the purpose was they were to take over Fitzgerald's Radio School, and they were used to two things. One was to contact the Ord, the arms ship that was coming in from Germany.
Of course, yeah.
Right? And also to transmit news of the rising. You know.
So it would be very significant for them to capture the radio base.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Now, the two boys set off from Limerick in the middle of the day on Good Friday. They were stopped a couple of times on the way by the RIC. The RIC seemed to be a little bit wary. They were aware that something was going down.
Yes.
But for the first time ever in Irish history, the RIC didn't really know what was happening. That was an awful affront to their dignity. Now, as I said, every rising, you know, was scuppered by the RIC because they had spies all over the place.
But for the first time, people successfully kept the secrets.
For the first time. The RIC knew there was something going down.
They didn't know what?
But they didn't know what.
Uh-huh.
And that was a total, something totally new for them. Anyhow, the two boys were stopped. They were stopped first at Newcastle West. But they had their cover was they were picking up men who were going fishing. You know,
right.
Fishing and shooting for the weekend. That was their cover. And a good one. So they arrived at Killarney about 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they picked up the five men, as I say, I named the five of them. And two of them sat in with Sam Windham, and the other three sat in with Tommy McInerney. Now, McInerney was driving a Briscoe car, very unusual car. Now, the thing about the Briscoe was it had one massive headlight. Right?
Just the one.
Sorry? Just the one. It was like the sidecar. No.
Yes, it's mad.
And the second car that Sam Windham was driving was a Maxwell.
OK. Okay.
Now, both McInerney and Windrum were from Limerick. Now, ironically, I worked with Windrum's brother and his nephew.
Okay.
In Matheson's. Windrum was, I think he was a fitter. Certainly his brother, Jimmy Windrum, was a fitter. Anyway, as I say, they picked up the five fellas in Killarney, and it was beginning to rain, and rain heavily. And they headed off for Cahasavine. Now, if you're going from Killarney to Cahasavine, you go through Killargan.
Yes.
And when they go through Killargan, they swing left up by the church and on out the road to Cahasavine. Now, Windrum, you know, he knew the route, so he drove straight, as I say, by the church and on towards Killarney. McInerney, however, it was raining heavily, and McInerney missed the turn off at the church. And he went down a road that takes you down to Ballykissand here. And it's lashing rain at this stage, it's pouring down. And the road and the river, you know, look almost like one.
Yes.
Now, this road takes you down onto Ballykissand here, a most dangerous road. Right? And it was only at the last minute that McInerney realised where he was, and he jammed on the brake, and he stopped with the car hanging over the edge of the pier.
What?
Now,
that's quite
something.
He managed
to get out.
Mm.
But in his getting out, he unbalanced the car. And it toppled into the river Lawn.
No.
And the other people fell down. Now, as I said, that's
Good Friday of the Easter week.
That was Good Friday.
Yeah.
Now, the other two fellas are, we say, Windrum and the other two fellas, they don't know this.
Yes.
Because they've gone ahead.
Sure.
Right? But they decided to stop and wait outside Cahasavine for the other car to catch up. But of course, as you, the other car...
Never came.
Now, the car was eventually fished out of the River Lawn. But they found the bodies of Charlie Monaghan and Sheehan.
Yes.
Fairly straight away.
Mm-hmm.
But the third man wasn't found for 6 months.
6 months?
Yeah, well, the remains of them were found.
Sure.
As I said, it was a bad start to the Easter weekend.
Yes.
Now, at the same time, the ship, the armed ship, the Ord, right, which was coming from Germany, arrived in Tralee Bay a day early. The preparations were very cack-handed.
That's it.
You know? And she's hanging around Tralee Bay waiting for the volunteers. Now, Austin Stack was the man supposed to be organising things.
Yes.
And, straight away, you'd imagine that Stack would have someone keeping an eye on Tralee Bay.
Well, you'd imagine, it's not ideal for something that's supposed to be a secret to be hanging around for a whole day waiting for somebody to liaise with them.
It was, yeah. And what happened was that the British Navy was suspicious. Okay?
Yes.
And they took it on board, right? Or took... They forced yard to follow them. They were going to take them to Cove,
mm-hmm.
right? And on the way to Cove, anyhow, the skipper of the yard, a fellow called Spindler, right? Enough was decided that enough was enough, that the English might get the ship, but they weren't getting the guns.
Okay.
So he scuttled his ship. He got his men to get into lifeboats, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lifeboat. And he scuttled his ship further into Cock Harbour. Now, as I say, that's a bad step. I mean, there was about 40,000 rifles and a couple of million rounds of ammunition.
That's it. And, you know, a hugely, hugely significant amount of munitions.
Yeah,
and,
it was.
And, no. You know, a huge loss at before anything even started.
That's what I'm saying. You know, before anything started...
Yeah, they were off to the wrong yeah, foot entirely, yeah.
The wrong foot, right. Now, the other thing about it was that the guns, the rifles that were on the yard... the Germans now were very cute. What they did was they shipped captured Russian rifles.
Mm-hmm.
When the Russian army surrendered to the Germans early in the First World War, they surrendered thousands of rifles and millions of rounds of ammunition.
Okay.
That's what the Germans... It wasn't modern German rifles that the IRB were expecting. It was antiquated Russian rifles with antiquated Russian ammunition. So the thing was, while these guns might be fine in their own right,
yes.
It's 2 to 3 million rounds of ammunition, right? Now that sounds a lot, but if you have a couple of thousand for the firing,
you'd get through it quite quickly.
You'll get through it quite quickly. And then you might as well throw your rifle in the river.
So you'd better off trying to hit them with the rifle because you're not going to have any ammunition that's going to fit it.
They'd be good for parade ground, you know.
Yes.
For parading and strutting around.
So it wasn't what they hoped for. It wasn't what they had anticipated.
It wasn't what they sent for.
Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't what they were promised. I mean, couldn't be the... Now, in the meantime, the... Three men that had been to Germany organising the arms shipment, right?
Yes.
Robert Monteith, Roger Casement, and a man called Bailey. They were landed in Tralee Bay from a submarine, right? Now, they were landed at Venus, or Alfeft, right? And they came ashore anyhow in a dinghy, and it was decided that Bailey and Bailey and Monteith were going looking for help.
Okay.
Casement wasn't in good nick, so he was to hide up in the sand dunes in Banner,
mm-hmm.
and his friend, right? And two boys would bring back help Tralee. But by the time the two boys got back from Tralee, Casement had been captured.
Now,
there's a lot of dispute about how loyal the people in that part of Kerry were.
Sure.
They would profess to be very Republican today, but when Casement and Monteith needed assistance, they weren't there. Anyhow, as I say, Casement was arrested. In the meantime, I don't know what happened with Bailey. He eventually turned state's evidence, anyhow.
Okay.
Monteith got into Tralee, and he got in contact with the volunteers, Tralee. Now, he was very lucky that he actually made contact with Tom McKillistrum and Charles Burns, and they were from Ballymacilligan, you know, and they were very good, they were very trustworthy. So at this stage the RIC knew that Monteith and was in the country, and they were looking for him around. They knew he was in Tralee, right?
Yes.
But as I said to you, it was a very wet night. So the volunteers prayed in Tralee, and then they decided to head for Ballymacilligan. Now, Ballymacilligan is between Tralee and Castle Island, which was an extremely staunch Republican area. And McKillistrum and Burns had Monteith inside in the middle of the Ballymacilligan contingent.
Yes.
And he literally marched out under the noses of the RIC.
Fantastic.
You know? Now, they hid him up for a number of weeks in the mountains around Ballymacilligan.
Sure.
But they knew that the RIC was closing in. So they arranged for him to go to Limerick, because Monteith had spent a lot of time in Limerick, and he was very familiar, especially with the Limerick city area. And he had friends there. And they drove him as far as Raheem. And he went across country to Killonan. Now, this would be probably the Tuesday of Easter week. You know, he was, as I said to you, maybe it was the Tuesday after Easter week.
Yes.
And he made his way to Killonan, right? And a big farmer, biggest farmer in the Moline parish, that's happened. He took him in, and that night Lappin was raided by the police. So they managed to get Monteith out into an outhouse where there was a labourer sleeping.
Yes.
He was sleeping in a loft, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they got Monteith up into the loft and in under the bed. Right? Now, an RIC man came up checking, right? And he was poking under the bed with a stick, right? He was actually poking Monteith.
Yes.
Without realizing it. And the man that was in the bed, I can't remember what his name was, but he was farm
level. Yes.
He played a brilliant role. Yes, he said, would you leave my old things alone? I'm bad enough. I said, without you poking at my old things. So the policeman got embarrassed and he stopped poking. And he was actually poking. He's actually poking Monteith.
Sure. Like, that's as close as you can ever come to being captured, isn't it?
That's as close. You can come without being.
Yeah, that's as close as it gets.
Now, as I say, now, think about it. This was April, right?
Yes.
The week after
Easter.
After the Easter rising, right? Monteith stayed in Killonan for 6 months. Now, Laffins knew he was there. Some of the workmen knew he was there.
Yes.
Right? Some of the neighbours knew he was there. But there was no cook to the RIC. And in November, right, in November 1916, Monteith was taken by Bart Laffin and his nephew, or his neighbour, Tim Hennessy.
Yes.
Or Dave Hennessy, right? Taken to Ballinasloe, where they met a car coming from Cork that took Monteith from Limerick. Monteith back to America, right? And he was there. He didn't come back to Ireland for 40 years, 30 years anyhow.
Well, yeah. he had a lucky escape, and I suppose he appreciated it.
Oh, he did, he did. Like, he wrote a very good account, which is very praiseworthy towards Laffan. Now, think about it. Laffan had a couple of hundred acres of land.
Yes.
He had something to lose. He wasn't your ordinary kind of revolutionary.
Yeah, no, he had a considerable amount to lose, and his reputation and everything as well along with it.
He was married to Dr. Lane's sister.
Yes.
Now, Paddy Lane, the chairman of the IFA one time, he would be, a nephew of Mrs. Athens. You were talking about people, dare I say, who had a big stake in the land.
Yes.
But when push came to shove, Monteith knew who he could rely on.
That's it. There was loyalty there, and true loyalty.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And as I say, that you would, if you said, who would be more helpful, revolutionists in Kerry or a big family in County Limerick? There wouldn't be too many picking the big family in County
there
Limerick.
There you go. You see, you can't judge the book by its cover.
You can't. Now, that was around the city. Now, there were other things, obviously, that happened. But the big thing that happened in County Limerick, on the Limerick Tipperary border on Easter week, there was a fellow called Michael Callaghan.
Yes.
He was a creamery manager. Now, in a Thieves Creamery, somewhere over near Latin, okay?
Okay.
And he lived in Tipperary town. He was a known Sinn Féin supporter. On the Tuesday of Easter week, right?
Yes.
He was going home to his father's house. Now, there was a thing called the Separation People. Now, these were people whose menfolk were serving in the British Army. In France and that, right?
Yeah.
And the reason they were called separation people was the wife got an allowance while her husband, now he gets some money as well, but she got an allowance
for subsistence, yes.
No, the famous British probably knew that to get all the money to the husband. Family might see it.
That's it.
The public might see it first. Anyhow, there was a whole sort of separation people.
And these would be the people taking the king's shilling, yes?
Taking the king's shilling. I couldn't put it better. they spotted him, and they started latching onto him and teasing him and taunting him, you see?
Yes.
And he got to the stage just as he was living in Henry Street in Tipperary, or O'Brien Street. Anyhow, when he got near his father's house, one of them got so bored, he made to strike at O'Callaghan with a stick. By God, if he did, O'Callaghan pulled the revolver and shot him in the leg.
He didn't try that again.
He didn't try that again. The youngster's name was Ryan. But anyhow, the police had been watching this from a distance.
Yes.
And you see, they would rejoice in any kind of discomfiture that O'Callaghan would have.
Of course.
But the moment he pulled the revolver, things changed dramatically. So he made it to his own house, right?
Yes.
And the police surrounded the house, but they weren't going to storm us. This man might shoot, you know.
That's it.
So the O'Callaghan realised that if he stayed in his father's house, he was hidden duck. So he got out the back and he headed for the hills, as I said. And he went to his cousin's house, a fella called Hennessy.
Okay.
Right? Who lived in Neil Ahalo at a place called Moore Nawr. Now, he lives in the parish in Galway, which is... Now, Moore Nawr actually is on the Tipperary side of the boundary, but if you know that all along the east and west Tipperary county boundary, there, I'd say there's no parish that has some part of it in either county.
Okay.
And we say Moore Nawr is in the parish of Galway, which is in the county of Tipperary, and that's where O'Callaghan went to. Now, the following morning, you see, the police, the thing about the RIC is they know everyone. They know who's related, they know who's your, they literally know what you had your dinner yesterday.
Yes.
You know? And they would straight away, they'd start raiding the relations. So these two policemen, Sergeant, I can't think of his name, O'Rourke, and Constable Hurley from Lisburnian, were tasked with calling on some of O'Callaghan's relations in the Arlo area.
Yes.
And they called to Hennessy's, right? And when they called, it was a cold day. Now, as I said, it was pouring rain, but it was cold, and it was a cold day in the Glen of Arlo.
Sure.
And the two boys were sitting down at the fire for Callaghan and Hennessy. And when the two policemen came in, I said they knew who they had, right? But they said, the sergeant said to O'Callaghan, you know, who are you?
Yes.
You know, can you give me identification? Give me your card or something like that. You know? And the man pulled the revolver, said, here's my card. He said, and he shot the policeman.
Yes.
That's the sergeant, right? And then he ran out the yard after the other man.
After the other policeman
was armed, but he panicked.
Yes.
He panicked, right? And O'Callaghan shot him as well. He shot him dead.
Okay.
Now, the policeman inside in the house, you know, lingered on. And O'Callaghan, he disappeared out of this. Now, just like we were talking about Monteith disappearing to America.
To America, yeah.
O'Callaghan did the same.
Okay.
And
did he stay there?
Sorry?
Did he stay in America once he got there?
He did. Mm. And they went to extradite him. But he was very, very fortunate. You don't extradite Irish during an election year.
Well, that's the truth.
O'Callaghan was very lucky. It was 1925 the time they discovered where he was.
Yes.
And 1920 was an election year.
Well, you don't want to disgruntle the Irish during an election year.
Yes, because they would have a lot of votes.
Sure.
So whilst they knew where O'Callaghan was, they were never able
to get him back.
No. He actually came back after the truce, and he ended up as the court clerk in Tipperary town. Now, who was related to him? Now, this you might find difficult to understand. Is Gretty Neville?
Oh,
he was Dan Neville's wife.
Yes.
Now, she was a niece of Michael O'Callaghan.
Of Callaghan, wow.
Oh, it's amazing how small the world is.
I was just going to say, it's a small world, you know.
No, it's an old link.
It's a small world, and Ireland is a very small microcosm
very small
of it.
Place. So, as I say, that would be most of it. Thinking of the odd.
Yes.
Effectively suffered any real chance of the rebellion in Dublin being successful.
Absolutely. It was a huge loss of munitions, a huge loss of useful guns.
And you see, the idea was that they would have landed the guns in Venus.
Yes.
They would have captured the train. Now, a lot of the planning, I think, is a little bit wishy-washy. No, they're planning to do a thing, but it's a bit unreasonable. But anyhow, the plan was they would load up the guns in Venus, right?
Yes.
And they would take them to around Tralee, take them to Limerick, and all the way. Now, the main depot in West Limerick that had mustered at St. Quinn Castle, the idea was that they were going to meet up with the train, I think, at Newcastle West.
Okay.
You know? And it would travel on to Limerick.
To Limerick and then, yeah.
And it would go from Limerick up to Clare, up to Galway.
Yes.
Picking up men all the way. And that these men would then march on Dublin, like you would take men from...
Limerick, Clare, and Galway. That would have been a hugely significant advantage.
It would have, but at the same time, you think the British didn't have garrisons on the way?
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, you know, in so much as we can kind of imagine it as a significant advantage, I'm sure that people would have noticed what was going on as well. And
what I think would have happened was they would have been wiped out eventually.
Yes.
Right. And we would never be in a position to mount what happened afterwards for a guerrilla warfare, which
yes.
at the end of the day, that's all we were ever going to win. As we took them on, as a field army, which was the idea.
Yeah. But they didn't have the men and the equipment.
Well, whatever about the men, they didn't have machine guns, they didn't have artillery.
It was a real David and Goliath affair.
Put it mildly.
Yeah.
Yeah, put it mildly.
It's been great. And you know what? It's been great to talk about, I suppose, events on Easter week outside of Dublin. Like, we're very familiar with the events in Dublin. It's great to kind of note the contributions that were happening in the other parts of the country. And I suppose, in a sliding door sort of way, to think about how things might have been if things hadn't happened the way they did.
Yeah, like the thing I have is there's big talk about there was a bit of a rising in Galway around Athenry.
Yes.
And there was a bit of a rising in Wexford around Enniscorthy. And I always say there was more policemen killed in the parish of Galway
Then
in Galway
and in
Enniscorthy
put together. Yeah, that's it.
And there's no talk about it.
There's no talk about it. Well, it's good. It's good to be talking about it today, Tom. And thanks so much for coming on. And happy Easter.
Thank you, Shelley.
Was on Good Friday morning, all in the month of May. A German ship was signalling beyond out in the bay. 20,000 rifles all ready for to land. But no answering signal did come from the lonely Bannerstrand. A motor car was dashing through the early morning gloom. A sudden crash and in the stream they went to meet their doom. Two Irish lads were dying there just like their hopes so grand. They could not give the signal now from the lonely Bannerstrand. No signal answers from the shore, Sir Roger sadly said. No comrades here to meet me, Alas, they must be dead. But I must do my duty, and at once I mean to land. So in a small boat rowed ashore to the lonely Bannisland. The German ship was lying there with rifles in galore. Up came a British ship and said, "No Germans reached the shore. You are our empire's enemy, and so we bid you stand. No German foot shall e'er pollute the lonely Bannisland." They sail for Queenstown Harbour, said the Germans, "We're undone. The British are our masters, man for man and gun for gun. We've 20,000 rifles here, but they'll never reach the land. We'll sink them all and bid farewell to the lonely Bannisland." Now the RIC were hunting for Sir Roger high and low. They found him at McKenna's fort. Said, "Hey, you are our folk." Said he, "I'm Roger Casement. I've come to my native land, and I mean to free my countrymen on the lonely Bannisland." They took Sir Roger prisoner and sailed for London town. And in the Tower they laid him as a traitor to the crown. Said he, "I am no traitor, but his trial he had to stand for bringing German rifles to the lonely Bannisland. Was in an English prison that they laid him to his death. I'm dying for my country," he said with his last breath. They buried him in British soil, far from his native land. And the wild wave sang his requiem on the lonely Bannisland. They brought Sir Roger home again in the year of 65. Now with his comrades of 16 and peace and tranquil life, his last fond wish it is fulfilled, for to lie on his native land. Now the waves can roll in peace again on the lonely Bannisland. Now the waves can roll in peace again on the lonely Bannisland. Been listening to A Window on the Past on West Limerick 102 FM.